We're delighted to have everyone who's visiting with us here today. Good to see Johnny and Rena here. I think he's caught all the fish he needs catching in Florida anyway, and needs to come back to Kentucky. We began last Sunday evening a series on Eve and her daughters, a celebration of the significance and excellence of women. And we're going to continue that this morning. And I want, if you would, to invite you to turn to the third chapter of 1 Peter, and we'll read a section of that in just a moment. There is about our current generation a distinct hatred of that which is feminine and that which is womanly. It is conceived to be in some way a disability foisted upon half of the human race by some societal conspiracy. It is sensed as a robbery of the rights of those who are born women. And I wanted, in this study, to celebrate the unique greatness of what God created when, in the apex of all He did, He made woman and presented her to her husband. To say that she is unique and special, that there are qualities in her that cannot be supplied by the male of the species, vital and essential to that image of God which is in humanity. So when he made them male and female. And they are not independent of each other, but they make a composite whole as a consequence of their uniting and being made one. So if you've had the feeling that you must endure this role in life, I'd like you to change your attitude. You do not realize what remarkable power you have. You do not realize what an elevated destiny it is to which God has called you. And if somehow we can get away from the notion that the role of submission is a denigrating, burdensome role, then somehow maybe we'll get closer to God and to His Son, and realize that even deity is submissive, even deity serves. In fact, we are serving today a servant God who empties Himself for the sake of others. For which cause I have said that women, because of this role, are found nearer to the character of God, perhaps. And because they are nurturers by design, they understand some things that their husbands need to learn and will be blessed to know and will be incomplete without. Today I want to read these verses with you as a beginning and to study with you one of the great women of the Old Testament. In like manner, you wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that even if any obey not the word, they may without the word be gained by the behavior of their wives. Beholding your chaste behavior coupled with fear, whose adorning let it not be the outward adorning of braiding the hair, of wearing jewels of gold, or of putting on apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart in the incorruptible apparel of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. For after this manner aforetime the holy women also who hoped in God adorned themselves, being in subjection to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose children you now are, if you do well, and are not put in fear of any terror. There are so many women in the Old Testament that deserve attention. It's difficult to choose the ones you'll talk about. And if I'm allowed, I'd think first of all of the wife of Noah. Because she and her husband, and she as much as her husband, lived some heroic lives and achieved some heroic ends in that time of absolute, total, unbroken degradation. You and I think we live in a bad world. We don't know what bad is. We've never lived in a situation and a place where everybody, without exception, is in rebellion against God and not just indifferent to Him, but living in violence and in a horrific pattern of lust and rebellion against God. We can't conceive that. That would be a darkness that we've never lived in spite of the difficulties of our own time. But Noah and his wife, and I will tell you, he not only did not do it without her, he would not have done it at all without her. And they managed to rear three sons in that hellhole of their times who loved God. And nobody else around them loved God. Schoolmates didn't love God. Neighborhood children didn't love God. Nobody around loved God. Nobody had any reverence for God. The life they lived was pathetic, morally and spiritually speaking. And yet they reared those boys in the midst of all that to love God. And they did something more than that. They reared those boys in such a way that when they went out to find mates, before they evidently received them as their mates, at least somewhere along the line, those young ladies became as God-fearing and as much in love with the great God of heaven as they were themselves. So that eight souls were saved by water, as 1 Peter 3 says, in another place. Now that's a wonderful story. A story of a heroic woman to achieve something that sometimes we doubt our ability to achieve. But this story tells us we can do it. And it doesn't make any difference how dark it gets on the outside. That our task remains the same and it's eminently possible for us to achieve it, and that is we're to rear our children in the fear of the Lord. That we are not to be in any sense intimidated by the society in which we live. We are in fact to live triumphantly above it by the values that God has taught us and by the fact that they have been driven deep within us by the cross. And that we don't have any desire to think any other way or to live any other way or for our children to do so. And I think about Jochebed, who is the wife of Amram. And you know her very well, don't you? The mother of Moses. And what she did during that period of distress for the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as a slave race, oppressed by an indifferent majority in the land of Egypt, and she preserved her son for 3 months. Not easy. Confident somehow that God would enable her to keep that lad and to in some way invest him with the truth of who he was and who God was so that he would never forget it, and she achieved that with her husband. Moses lived in the palace of Egypt, but he never forgot who he was. He never forgot who he was. It is our task as parents to do that. Women achieve that in remarkable ways. Our study this morning is about another great woman of the Old Testament. She was not without fault. No great women are. No great men are. And so when we look back on our own lives and see the places where we didn't do well, we ought not to be discouraged by that insofar that we think, well, we've already destroyed the possibility of living a life that's really fruitful, really meaningful, that will really achieve something, because that's not true. And I would like this story today to make that contribution to you. Many men have affectionately called their wives princess. It doesn't have to be one of mine, although it would be appropriate. But there's only one woman in human history that God not only called princess, but named princess. And that's Sarah, which is the meaning of her name as spelled with the final H. Princess. I suspect that it was God's way of saying she is going to be the mother of a significant people. And she absolutely did become that. She was beautiful in person and more beautiful in character. She is the first woman. I think it's safe to say she's the first woman in history. And I take the Bible as being the earliest history we have recorded even comparing it with secular material, that she's the first woman in human history to stand out distinctly and be distinctly portrayed, so that her character comes through very fully. And the scripture is filled with the figure of her husband. Abraham is there from the 11th chapter of Genesis all the way through the epistles of Paul. His character just overarches everything. And she's in the shadows. And some people don't like to be in the shadows. No one ought to resent or resist being in the shadows if it's an opportunity to serve selflessly. So she was, but she's always there, and her presence is always felt and felt strongly and influentially in the life of her husband. And Abraham never would have achieved what he achieved had it not been for her. He would have done just a second-rate job. What I'm saying to you is he wouldn't have achieved it. She was a remarkable partner. I want to begin this study by thinking about her as the beautiful and faithful woman that she was. She really had an unusual relationship with Abraham. First of all, she was his half-sister. She and Abraham had two brothers that are named in the scripture, Nahor and Haran. Haran died before they ever left Ur of the Chaldees. And Nahor, her brother, had married Haran's daughter, Milcah. And from that union had come a son along with seven others that was named Bethuel. And from Bethuel had come a daughter by the name of Rebekah. About that story, and she had a brother named Laban. He was not too admirable a character, but nonetheless, Rebecca was a wonderful lady. But there was intermarriage here in the family. But perhaps none quite so close as Abraham and Sarah, because they were half brother and sister. As Abraham later explained to Abimelech, the prince of Gerar, she's my father's daughter, but not my mother's daughter. And she became my wife. Now, this is before the law of Moses is given and before those close ties are prohibited. And so, she is his wife and his sister, and that truth got to be a problem in their lives, actually. She was 10 years younger than her brother. When they left Haran, the first stop on their journey to the land of Canaan, according to the instruction, the call of God, she was 65 years old. Still capable of bearing children. No reference to any problem. 65 years old. Already ready for full retirement, Social Security, Medicare in our time. 65 years old. And as soon as they get into the land of Canaan, and this is not the way to begin. It's hard for women to be pulled up and go somewhere else. You think about this. It was all right. It was a challenge for Abraham to go out, as the Hebrews 11 says, not knowing where he was going. He didn't have any idea where he was going. He'd never been down to see the real estate. God just said, you get up, you go to the land that I will show you. But if it was tough for Abraham, let's remember it was really tough for Sarah. They were leaving Ur of the Chaldees, which was a remarkable city in the ancient world. Archaeologists digging it up found out it had running water in the homes. Nice homes, settled life. You knew where you were going to sleep the next night. You had some idea of what life was going to be like. The situation of the city provided all kinds of amenities for that time. It was a city that was situated not too far from the Garden of Eden and to the rich delta of the Tigris and Euphrates. And it wasn't leaving Podunk when they left. They left something that was significant. And she left just like he did. And I want to say again that there's nothing more precious than the way a woman gives herself and her destiny in the hands of a man. And so Sarah had done with Abraham what he was going to do, she was going to do with him. And I am persuaded that her faith was alongside his own. And that she too is responding to what God wants her to do, leave family and go out to another place and to a destiny that is yet to be unfolded. But she goes, and as soon as they get down in this strange land where they're dwelling in tents, I mean, this is not something she was accustomed to. Wasn't anything Abraham was accustomed to. They become Bedouins out there, wandering about, sheep herders, goat herders, camel owners. That's something that had not been probably true of them before. And a famine strikes the land immediately. 12th chapter of Genesis, already got famine, already had to leave the territory, run down to Egypt, find something to eat, because that was the breadbasket of the ancient world, where the Nile continued to flood every year, and they always had something to eat, usually. And then Abraham said, "Now, Sarah, you are a beautiful woman. 65 years old. You are a beautiful woman. And when we go down here and these fellows see you, when Pharaoh sees you, he's going to say, she is his wife, and then they will kill me in order to take you." Now, I want you to think about that. If ever you entertained the thought that you were beautiful, and some of you have every cause to entertain that thought, physically, you think about a 65-year-old woman whose beauty is still flowering, and who is going to be attractive to Pharaoh, who had all kinds of access to beautiful women. Now, this man is not destitute of access to beautiful women. And when he saw her, he added her to his harem, because of the ruse which they decided to use, and that is to say, he is my brother, which of course was true, but it wasn't whole truth. Now, Abraham's faith fails here. It's a weakness of Sarah, but it was his idea. Look, he's the husband. He should have protected his wife. He should have protected his wife. Instead, he virtually hands her over to Pharaoh. You know, help yourself, just so long as I can escape myself. I don't want to make this any worse than it is. I'm just simply saying to you that this man who left in utter and absolute trust out of the Ur of the Chaldees and away from Haran to go where God has told him to go, he's not a man without faith, but I want to tell you, at this point, he's not looking good. You ever have lapses like that? A faithful individual, you've done some things that demonstrate the fact you trust in God, no question about that, but here's a moment of weakness, and you just didn't get it right. This is not one of Abraham's greatest moments. First of all, it was an idea to deceive somebody, and second of all, he didn't take care of his wife like he should have. It was his responsibility and task to take care of her, and she goes along with it. But that doesn't tell you how beautiful the woman was. Genesis 20, another famine. She is 90 years old, and her womb is dead. And they go down toward the plains country, toward the sea, the Mediterranean, into the land of Gerar, ruled over by the king whose name was Abimelech, and the same story is told because of the same concern. You feature this. 90 years old, and Abimelech, who's the prince, the king of Gerar, who also would not have had any kind of paucity of beautiful women. And he sees her and takes her into his house. And before he can marry her, God intervenes the second time to prevent it. I want to make this observation that both Pharaoh and Abimelech of Gerar understood the sin of adultery. They both recognized it was sinful. The reign of the moral supremacy of God was not just over Abraham and Sarah and their descendants. This was something known and understood by humankind, nations abroad. And it started with Adam. And all men and all women since that time have been obligated by God's design and by his intention for us to keep his will. Just because we never made any religious pretensions does not relieve us of responsibility to obey God. Now, never has. But 90 years old, beautiful. I'd say this is remarkable. And to it all, it seems to me what Peter was talking about in chapter 3 is being demonstrated. She was beautiful in appearance, but the indication is she never ever entertained one thought of ever being anybody's wife but Abraham's. She never had an eye for nor an interest in any other man. She was devoted to him, faithful to him. And more than that, she was submissive to him. Why do you suppose Peter is still on that subject all these hundreds of years later? Why does he imperil the beauty of her submission?
Well, the modern answer is because the world of Sarah's day was really backward, and the world of Peter's day, though he was enlightened, it was still very backward, and so they had to make all kinds of accommodations to the backwardness of the times. And so in order to deal with those unique days, they said, be submissive to your husband. As we noted last week, that cannot wash. It is absolutely preposterous. The Apostle Paul argues from creation for the submission of the woman. Now, don't look on that as being somehow denigrated. Don't look on that as somehow slavery. That's the idea is absolutely consistent with the whole character of Christ and of our Father and the kind of character we ought to have ourselves. We all must submit, and we must learn submission. And as we stressed in our last study in the fifth chapter of Ephesians, the parents must submit to the children, and the masters must submit to their servants, and husbands must submit to their wives. In what sense? The sense of Ephesians 5:21, subjecting yourselves one to another in the fear of Christ, that is, subjecting your needs to her needs, subjecting your needs to the needs of the other. Any service you give in terms of leadership is intended to bless the other person, not you. So submission is not something that's foreign to being a Christian. It is absolutely essential at the heart of being a Christian. So don't resent it. To submit to serve. All of us must submit to serve. God has submitted his rights to our needs and emptied himself for our sake. Have we not learned that lesson yet? Feminism, by its nature, is anti-Christian. And any disposition on any of our parts to love leadership as bossism is also anti-Christian. The idea that we are given a role of leadership so we can serve ourselves, that's the attitude that some have. That's pathetic. And so also it's disappointing to find women resenting the role of submission in marriage. It does not take away from you significance. It does not take away from you power. Does it take away from Christ power because he dies for others, denying his own rights? The truth of the matter is, it's the power of that cross that converted every last one of us. It is the kind of love that is celebrated in the role of women that is powerful to change the hearts of children and to mold and shape them. And not only that, but to change the hearts and lives of husbands. It is a redemptive kind of role and should not be despised at all. So don't ever speak with despising of it or feel that. Another quality that is spoken of here, and I want to stress, is the fact that she, like other holy women, put the emphasis not on her physical beauty. And if some of us have cause to feel that way about ourselves today, she had more cause. And if she had wanted to be captivated by her beauty and be driven to silliness because all the men around were finding her attractive, look, I mean, a lot of cause for vanity here. Go down to Egypt and you got the king of Egypt, Gaga, over you. And you go down when you're 90 years old and you got the prince of Gerar. He's just all filled with attraction for you. Well, you know, you get to thinking, well, maybe, you know, I really got something here. Let me tell you, physical beauty is a special trial. I never suffered that trial. I mean, I've had others, but it's never been my burden. I didn't celebrate it as a young man, but I'm celebrating it now. You know, I'm glad for it. It's a burden. And the reason it's a burden is because people look at you and what they see is what's on the outside. And they're attracted to you because of that. They have no idea about anything within, any worth that you may have, the depth of your character. They have no concern for that. They're just mindless themselves, superficial themselves, and so they come at the superficial level toward you. Young people, I especially warn you. You young ladies that at this particular time are celebrating the beauty of your person. And it's all right if you can get it on. Most people in their adolescence, they're despairing of their ugly features. You know, everything is wrong here. Nothing is right. You can't really see yourself at that point. But if you happen to be physically attractive, don't get too excited about that, because there's going to be a lot of numbskull boys hanging around, don't have any more sense, and just be attracted to that. They don't care about what else happens. They don't know whether you got any sense at all. Mindless. You don't want your daughter to be surrounded by the likes of that. You don't want that. And so please do not put the emphasis on getting your daughter all dressed up and dolled up so she can really make the headlines in the local high school, because she is the favorite of everybody. Woe unto you when all men speak well of you. Jesus said that, because that's what they said about the false prophets. Don't do that. And don't you do that. As a godly woman, don't put the emphasis on the external. Now, it's all right. We read the scriptures, and godly women did adorn themselves. It was evidently, it's a feminine thing to do. It's attractiveness. But remember that character is always the most important thing. And that what we wear and how we deport ourselves all must bespeak something within that says, God is the king of my life. And I have no intention of doing anything that would bring shame on him. Let everything you do reveal the fact that you are far more concerned about the incorruptible apparel of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God a great price. And don't you ever think that that meek and quiet spirit cannot break the bone. Women have tremendous power over their husbands and over their children and over many others. It's sort of like that little plant that starts growing in the crack of concrete. You give that plant time, if it's the right plant, and it will crack the whole thing. It's just not spectacular or dramatic, but very, very powerful. But then there's a second phase of her life we'll deal with rather quickly, and that is the despairing and jealous wife. She had despaired of children by the time they got down to Hebron, and she's 75 years old, the Oaks of Mamre, it's sometimes called. So far, only Abraham's been told he'll have a child. She'd never been told she'd have a child. Abraham's been told he'll have a child. And so Sarah just gives up on God. This is the low point in her life. She just decides God needs some help here. And so, because Hagar is my possession, she is my handmaid, she's the slave girl in the house, this Egyptian girl, I'll just give her to Abraham, and anything she gets will be mine, and we'll just take care of it this way. And so she gives Hagar to Abraham. And it is known from other sources that that was customary to be done during that period of time. Archaeological findings have shown that that was the case. And so she does something that was very stupid. And it cost her a lot, really. So she gives to her husband another woman, and she conceives. And as soon as she conceives, she can't do enough to show her contempt for her barren mistress. She prances around the house, evidently just throwing herself and all. She can do what her mistress cannot. She has done it. And not only that, it gets so bad that Sarah deals hardly with her. She says to Abraham, you know, look at this woman. You judge between us. Just as soon as she has conceived a child, she treats me like I'm dirt. And Abraham says, she's your servant. And I don't know whether it was Sarah's fault or the natural consequence of the behavior of Hagar. But finally, things got so bad that Hagar ran off, left, and an angel sends her back again. But things are not happy. And they're not going to be happy in this way. I want to mention to you the fact that all this talk about when we are divorced and remarried, that the only thing we need to do, if we shouldn't have gotten that divorce and we shouldn't be married again, is say, Lord, I'm sorry about that. I just shouldn't have done it. And we'll just try to make this one work better than the last one. And each time that happens, we just say we're sorry about that and we'll go on. Is that that must apply to polygamy too? Why not? You shouldn't have married two wives. And now we're just sorry we did that. We're not going to get very upset about this in the United States of America, because since the Mormons have been put down in their disposition to polygamous marriages, we don't ever face it. But there are many countries in this world where it is not illegal to have a plurality of wives. Now, where you will have to face it. And people are going to come to you and want to be Christians, and they've got four wives. And what are you going to say to them? Polygamy is an absolute horror.